We're discussing the Senate's supermajority requirement under which 60 votes are necessary to pass most bills and why it's far from what the Constitution's framers had in mind. We're looking at Senate rules informed by history here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the 100-member Senate, it takes 60 votes to end debate and move most bills to a vote. And this rule sets a high bar for a new president's policy agenda. What questions do you have about how the filibuster works? What type of legislation do you think should require more than a majority vote to pass? Do you think our country has minority rule now? 800-642-1234. Adam Gentleson is former Deputy Chief of Staff to Senator Harry Reid, the former Democratic leader. Adam's book is called Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Adam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, the problems with the filibuster in modern times, you frame it through the 2012 Newtown massacre, the unspeakable tragedy of 20 first graders, six educators in a mass shooting on that horrible December day. So in the wake of Sandy Hook, the Manchin-Toomey Amendment, which would have required universal background checks, that fails in the Senate. What happened?
Yeah, this was a turning point for me in my career and way of thinking about the Senate, because this Manchin-Toomey background checks amendment that you mentioned, you know, had everything that you would expect a bill to need to become a law in our system. It was co-sponsored by bipartisan senators, a Democratic senator from West Virginia, Joe Manchin, a Republican senator from Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey. It had a bipartisan group of senators in support of it, 55 senators that represented a healthy majority of the chamber. It had the support of a broad range of interest groups from the right, including gun rights groups and, of course, left-wing gun control groups. And it had the support of 88% of the American people. So, you know, nearing consensus behind this policy as a modest step in the right direction after this unspeakable massacre. But it failed. And it failed on a filibuster. And the filibuster that it failed on didn't look anything like what most people think of when they think of the filibuster. There was no Jimmy Stewart moment. There was nobody on the floor giving a long speech trying to delay this bill. There were really very few people on the floor at all explaining their opposition to the bill. Quite simply, the opponents of the bill were able to raise the threshold for the number of votes it took to pass this bill from the simple majority, where most bills used to pass in the Senate and where the threshold was set for most of the Senate's existence. And they were able to raise it up to a supermajority of 60 votes. And that's when the bill failed. And there was no speeches. There was just quiet failure in this nearly empty chamber. And that's what the filibuster has become.
I was struck that the 45 senators who voted down the background checks bill, they represented just 38% of Americans. That was
a pretty
astounding statistic.
Yeah, that's right. And so this is, you know, the Senate has always been about representing the individual states and not populations. That's why we have a bicameral legislature where the House is, you know, states are given representation proportional to their population. So California has 53 members in the House of Representatives, where Wisconsin only has one. But in the Senate, Wisconsin has two senators and California also has two senators. But this small state bias, small states by that measure get more representation than big states. But this didn't used to have a partisan lean. Democrats and Republicans used to represent big and small states in roughly equal proportions. It's only very recently that this has started to shift into giving Republicans a decisive advantage. This is because of the underlying shift of white working class and largely rural voters who've settled into the Republican Party, where they used to often vote Democratic. But that has developed into a strong advantage for Republicans. And this is something that the framers were concerned about. James Madison, who's often cited as the chief proponent of minority rights at the Constitutional Convention, was opposed to the idea of giving equal representation to every state. He called it a source of grave injustice. And at that time, the biggest state, Virginia, was only 10 times bigger than the smallest state. Today, California is 70 times bigger than Wyoming. So if Madison thought this was a source of injustice back in 1789, he would certainly think it was a source of injustice today.
We're talking with Adam Gentleson, who's the author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy, which is a deep dive into the power of the filibuster rule, how it has evolved, and taking your questions about the filibuster. What are your thoughts on it? Where is its place as a rule in the Senate? 800-642-1234. You mentioned the actor Jimmy Stewart in this in his role in that 1939 film, Mr. Smith Goes to Hollywood, in this marathon filibuster. How does, you know, filibusters, not in the movies, but how does a filibuster work in the real world, in the Senate chamber?
Yeah, and the funny thing about that movie was it was roughly based on a true story. But in real life, the senator who uncovered this corruption that Jimmy Stewart uncovers in the movie didn't do it through a filibuster. The filibuster had nothing to do with it. It was done through hearings and investigations. So Frank Capra, the director, needed a way to dramatize this, you know, underdog standing up to the big guy. So he chose the filibuster, and that's our lasting memory. But it is a reasonably accurate representation of how the filibuster used to work. And again, even this version of the filibuster wasn't part of the Constitution. It was not something the framers intended. They wanted the Senate to be deliberate and thoughtful, but for debate to be topical and not obstructive. But starting in the middle of the 19th century, senators started to innovate this idea that we would sort of label the talking filibuster, where they would just stand on the floor and give a long speech to try to delay a bill that they opposed and sort of force that bill's proponents to make some tough choices, maybe try to run out the clock and run them up against a deadline or something like that. They could coordinate with their allies to pass the baton back and forth so they could extend the amount of time past what any individual senator could have the stamina for. And this was a reasonably effective measure for delaying and obstructing bills and forcing the majority to make tough choices, but it almost never succeeded in stopping bills altogether, because at the end of the day, the majority could just wait them out. Mm. And maybe they'd have to, you know, choose one thing over another, but they very rarely were forced to give up on the bill. And that started to change in the 20th century when the filibuster started to acquire this supermajority threshold that we associate with it today.
When you were working in the Senate as an aide to Harry Reid, how often was the filibuster used to kill legislation? How active was it?
Almost literally all the time. You know, what happened is that through the second half of the 20th century, the filibuster became much more easy to use and also more powerful. So it went from this talking filibuster that we think of when we think of it to a silent filibuster where nobody needs to be on the floor like we saw with the Manchin-Toomey bill, but they're able to do something more powerful than just delay the bill. They're able to increase the number of votes it takes to pass the bill, which is often enough to kill major pieces of legislation, especially in our relatively polarized or a very polarized era today. So that sort of easy to use but more powerful filibuster under Senator McConnell, who was the Republican leader under President Obama and continues to be the Republican minority leader today, his big innovation was to start applying that sort of user-friendly but also very powerful filibuster to everything that came before the Senate. And I'm not talking, you know, major pieces of legislation. I'm talking literally every piece of routine business the Senate had to do. Before McConnell, leaders of both parties were using the filibuster more frequently. And I should be clear about that Democrats also deployed it when they were in the minority. But McConnell's innovation was to use it against everything, to not just block individual pieces of legislation, but create a larger sense of gridlock so that, you know, performing routine business in the Senate became like, you know, slogging through a swamp of molasses. And so I'm pretty comfortable saying that virtually everything that came before the Senate when I was there faced this higher threshold of votes to clear.
What did it take to get a bill approved by the Senate, a bill through the Senate?
Well, you know, for routine consensus pieces of legislation, you could eventually get the 60 votes you needed to clear these hurdles. Mm-hmm. But what McConnell understood was that it takes about a week to do that. If you force the other side to jump through all of the procedural hoops that it takes to clear this threshold, it takes, you know, 5 to 6 days to jump through those hoops. And so even for routine bills where you knew you had the votes, it still took a long time. And of course, time is a zero-sum entity. And, you know, all the time it took to get through the routine business left you less time to do the actual work of legislating. So every bill needed 60 votes to clear. And even those that could get 60 votes took much longer than they needed to.
Author Adam Gentleson with us. He's taken a deep look at the power of the filibuster in the Senate, the power of obstruction. He's a former senior aide, now executive director of Battleborn Collective, a progressive group that strategizes political messages and legislation. Is our government able to address the major issues our country faces now with the rules that exist in the Senate? 800-642-1234. Share your thoughts. Back in a minute with Adam Gentleson here on the Ideas Network. You're with us as we look at the filibuster in the Senate, what it means for advancing policy agenda in America. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. Progressives have been pressuring Senate Democrats to abolish the filibuster, but Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia has resisted. He made a small opening recently saying he wants it to be a little more painful for senators who block legislation. He told Axios on HBO.
The pain basically is the filibuster, talking filibuster they've talked before. Some of the rules could be changed a little bit, but not to the point where just a simple majority rules.
How do you feel about the Senate's 60-vote threshold? Adam Gentleson's new book is called Kill Switch. It's a deep dive into the filibuster, and he's with us for the hour. Let's bring in a call now. Dan is with us in Platteville. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Hello?
Yes, hi.
Okay, so first, I just want to address the issue at the beginning about the gun control legislation. And the thing a lot of people... I think even people in our government don't really realize when it comes to like a gun control issue, that is tied to the Second Amendment, which is one of our core civil liberties, our core rights, the same as, you know, our First Amendment, our Fourth Amendment, our Eighth Amendment. And the issue is if you just have a simple majority basically being able to decide which rights should be protected or not, you know, that could be very detrimental to our republic because, you know, think if this was a First Amendment issue, you know, could you imagine if the Republicans said, you know, we're going to pass a law saying you can't make fun of Republicans, or, you know, or the Democrats made a law, you can't make fun of Democrats. If they're controlling the majority, that could be really bad. And it's the same thing if it's the Second Amendment issue. So that's why the supermajority is important. Also, one more point with how you mentioned how I'm not saying this is exactly how things are going, but with Mitch McConnell wanting to use a supermajority for almost every bill, I think part of the problem is we have bills that are just so huge that they require a lot of, we'll just say, process. I mean, think of this recent COVID stimulus. It took 10 hours to read. No bill should take 10 hours to read, much, you know. Shouldn't even take 10 hours to write.
Dan, thank you. I'm going to have Adam here jump in with those insights. Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, Dan raises an interesting point, you know, that the fear of untrammeled majority rule is certainly something the framers had in mind when they created the Senate in the first place, and is something they discuss often in the Federalist Papers. But their thinking on this was that they created a system by having a bicameral legislature, a House, a Senate, having a president who had to sign or veto the laws, and having a judiciary that would uphold the laws. Their thinking was that they had created enough checks and balances to prevent untrammeled majority rule from taking place. And that was without the filibuster. They did not think the filibuster should be in place. They thought every decision point within this system should be majority rule. And that was the balance they tried to strike. And to Dan's point, you know, I think what's interesting about the bill that we're talking about, this was virtually a consensus piece of legislation. I don't think there were any real objections raised or concerns that establishing universal background checks in any way violated the Second Amendment. And I think what this shows is that even just getting a majority in both houses and getting signed by a president does do what the framers intended. It requires legislation to be generally very moderate and reflect a broad consensus. And this is a bill supported by 88% of the American people. So, you know, there's always going to be some people who object to the bills that pass, but this system was designed to allow pieces of legislation that have a broad consensus behind them to pass. And I think on the side, and so this, you know, I would say the background checks amendment, you know, was not a controversial piece of legislation. That's what made it significant. When you have 88% of the American people behind something, that's, you know, you're reaching consensus levels there. On the size of legislation, I would say, you know, the reason the COVID bill, part of the reason it was so big and had to be rolled into one package is that to pass it, legislators needed to use an end run around the filibuster called the reconciliation process. If the filibuster wasn't in place, they wouldn't have had to use this process. And that process sort of forces you to roll everything up into one giant package. Without having to take that end run, they could have gone through regular order and brought individual pieces to the floor, had them go through, had them go through committee processes, you know, individually, had more oversight and transparency in the process. So the filibuster is forcing these sort of, you know, a lack of transparency and these sort of end runs around the regular order process that I think is unhealthy. But of course, they had to use that process because they were fairly certain that Republicans were going to all vote against this bill. That end run allowed them to pass it on a majority vote basis. And they were correct in that calculation. We saw every single Republican member of Congress in both houses vote against this very desperately needed piece of legislation that was backed by, you know, a broad consensus of economists as necessary and health officials, and supported by, again, 75% of the American people. So, you know, the filibuster is creating these sort of perverse incentives and making the system unhealthy, whereas if it was gone, you could just bring it to the floor, have oversight, have committee hearings, and pass it that way.
We're talking with Adam Gentleson, who's explaining the evolution of the filibuster rule in the Senate. His new book is called Kill Switch, getting your insights on the filibuster, how it works, the history of it. 800-642-1234. We're going to look more here at the history, specifically the Jim Crow era. Tom is joining us from Burlington. Hi, Tom. What would you like to say?
My father was a member of the House of Representatives in 1957, and he was appointed the floor leader. He had to be the floor leader and put the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Act of 1957, through the House of Representatives. And Sam Rayburn, who was the House Speaker at the time, said, "Charlie, you have to put it through, because if I do, I will not be reelected." So my father got it through the House of Representatives, and then it went up to the Senate. And when it got to the Senate, Strom Thurmond from North Carolina got up, and he read the everything that was from the the Constitution. He read the Constitution of every state. Anyway, he talked for 24 hours and 22 minutes.
Yeah.
And then they finally were able. They were bringing cots in so the senators could sleep on the floor, and it was. You know how it is when you're up all night. It's one of those things.
And Tom, anyway, Adam writes extensively about this history. Adam, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, Tom. This was a fascinating episode. And you're right that this bill, you know, the 1957 Civil Rights Act, when it was sent up to Congress by the Eisenhower administration, it was a very strong piece of legislation, you know, comparable in many ways to the bill that was passed in 1964, which we celebrate, obviously, as the first major civil rights legislation to pass. And, you know, it's an episode that I love because it shows how different the parties were at the time. This was a Republican administration that was being more aggressive in favor of civil rights than Democrats were. Eisenhower arguably had a better record on civil rights than Truman or even FDR. He'd been very aggressive on it. He'd run in 1956 with the endorsement of the NAACP of prominent black leaders like Adam Clayton Powell, a Democratic congressman from Harlem, and Jackie Robinson and other national black leaders. And he promised to do away with the filibuster to pass a strong civil rights bill. So in January of 1957, after Eisenhower is reelected in a landslide, he wins 40% of the black vote, which, you know, Republicans today can only dream of. Today, Republicans typically get around 10 or 12%. Eisenhower sends up this strong bill. And as Tom said, it passed the House. Richard Nixon, who is Eisenhower's vice president, aligns and allies with Senate liberals like Hubert Humphrey and Paul Douglas. And they make an attempt to get rid of the filibuster in January of 1957 in order to be able to pass the stronger version of this civil rights bill that passed the House. Lyndon Johnson, the Democratic Senate leader at the time, gets together with Southern senators and blocks Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey and the Senate liberals from reforming the filibuster, and then proceeds to gut this strong civil rights bill over the course of the summer of 1957. And even though Strom Thurmond ended up filibustering it at the end, what Johnson did was he took out every single thing that made this bill effective and made it so toothless that it was eventually acceptable, not to Thurman, but to most of his other Southern colleagues. And so after Thurman's individual filibuster, the other Southern senators dropped their group filibuster and let this bill pass. So it was a moment in history where you almost had Republicans establish themselves as the party of civil rights. But the bill that they ended up passing, because Johnson and the Democrats gutted it, was so toothless that many civil rights leaders almost didn't endorse it. It ended up being a first step in the right direction. And 7 years later, they passed the 1964 Act, which actually did have an impact. But it was a clear demonstration of the use of the filibuster. There were test votes over the summer that showed that before the bill was gutted, the strong version would have passed with a majority of votes in the Senate if it had been allowed to.
We have author Adam Gentleson chronicles the rise of the Senate's filibuster, first appearing in the mid-1800s after all the framers to the Constitution had died. And as Adam writes, the need to maintain slavery led Southerners to search for new ways of defying the majority. What are the implications of the filibuster rule today? Do you think Democrats should end the filibuster, as many are calling for? Or would this decision come back to haunt them? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Adam Gentleson after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the Senate's filibuster rule here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Over the years, senators on both sides of the aisle have called for reforms in the face of partisan gridlock. In 2013, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid had enough of what he saw was relentless obstruction of Obama's nominees, and he used the nuclear option, calling for a vote to change the Senate rules by a simple majority vote.
Gridlock has consequences, and they're terrible. It's not only bad for President Obama, bad for this body, the United States Senate. It's bad for our country. It's bad for our national security and bad for economic security. That's why it's time to get the Senate working again.
And it passed. What do you think of the way the filibuster is deployed today? 800-642-1234. Former senior aide to Reid, Adam Gentleson's book is called Kill Switch, and he's with us for the hour. Adam, you say you lay blame squarely on Southern senators who you say invented it, strengthened it, developed alternative histories to justify the filibuster. Why is your blame so clear here to you?
Well, you know, it's true that senators of both parties and all ideologies would occasionally use the filibuster. A great example from Wisconsin is Senator Fighting Bob Robert La Follette, which we can talk about more in a minute. But when you look at who created the filibuster, who innovated it, who strengthened it, and why they did so, there's no way to avoid the conclusion that it was Southern senators throughout history. And not just, you know, a regional affiliation here. They had a clear intent, and they were rather explicit about it. It's a bit of an open and shut case because, especially in earlier eras, they were not shy about declaring in no uncertain terms that their aim was the preservation of white supremacy. And I don't use that term lightly. Those are terms that they used themselves to declare what their goals were. And so in the 19th century, the origins of the filibuster and the talking filibuster that we think of lay squarely with Senator John Calhoun of South Carolina, who innovated this in a way that nobody else did. And, you know, this was something that was not what the framers intended. It was not in the Constitution. And Calhoun explicitly stated that he believed that the system that James Madison had designed provided insufficient power for a minority that wanted to obstruct the will of the majority. Calhoun wrote a tract called Disquisition on Government, in which he stated that Madison's system had insufficient power for the minority. And Calhoun said that what he sought was to allow the minority to have a veto over the majority. Hmm. Madison's system gives the minority a voice and a role in the process and input. Calhoun wanted the minority to be able to block them altogether. And then you fast forward to the 20th century in the Jim Crow era, Southern senators who were very clearly stating that their goal was the maintenance of white supremacy. They were led by Richard Russell of Georgia, who said, quote, any Southern man worth a pinch of salt would give his all to maintain white supremacy, end quote. They applied what we now associate with the filibuster of the supermajority threshold. And this was because civil rights bills, anti-lynching bills, anti-poll tax bills, and anti-discrimination bills were passing the House of Representatives by wide margins, starting in as early as the 1890s, but very frequently after the 1920s and 1930s, coming over to the Senate, where they had majority support, and they had presidents of both parties ready to sign them. So the Southern senators of that era needed to increase the power of the minority over what Calhoun had been able to do to stop the advance of progress supported by the majority. So, you know, it's those innovations that created the filibuster as we know it today and give it its essential power. And they all came from Southern senators with a clear mission of maintaining white supremacy and maintaining the oppression of Black Americans.
And to be noted, too, Russell has a long career in the Senate, almost 40 years from the 30s to early 70s. So long lasting implications.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And, you know, he gave the filibuster much of its power. And, you know, one thing that's notable is that, you know, efforts to reform the filibuster never really stopped. They started almost immediately when Calhoun was plying his innovations in the 1840s. Henry Clay of Kentucky, the great compromiser, rose up and tried to stop him and tried to do what we would today call going nuclear in order to stop Calhoun and get rid of this filibuster that Clay, you know, a great leading light of the Senate, immediately identified as a major risk to the institution. Mm. And that tradition continued up to today. But in the 1940s against Russell, you had senators continually trying to reform the filibuster. But Russell was a master tactician, and every single time he was able to outmaneuver them. But this is when we talk about, you know, Senate myths and tradition. You know, it's a lot of power plays waged by individual people seeking to increase their power, as Russell was trying to do, that gets wrapped up in this sort of fog of myth and tradition. And part of what the book tries to do is tear down a lot of those myths and see these events for what they really were.
Let's bring in Paul, who is joining us from Menominee Falls this morning. Hi, Paul. What would you like to add?
Hi, great, very illustrative discussion. Just a kind of a human fingerprint on this. I cried by myself in my classroom when I listened, as I'm a fifth grade teacher at the time, listened to the events unfold at Sandy Hook and then dried my tears so that I could be my best for my students when they came back in. And as I listened to your guest, just a wonderful job, Adam, with your research, just exemplary. I feel as if I want a supermajority. However, because of the way things are going and there's so much gridlock, it's untenable to think that we have this majority of people that were just in that specific case going to support that measure but did not. And I guess my thinking here is, isn't it time for us in this century to go beyond the representative government that we have now? If there's so much gridlock and they are not representing the will of the people, what's the next step beyond filibusters and gridlock so that we, in fact, can have confidence that the laws that we feel are just and right are going to be passed?
Mm. Paul, thank you so much. If not the filibuster, what will foster compromise, Adam?
Yes, thank you, Paul, for your points, and I appreciate you raising this. And I, you know, this is an interesting point because it's a little counterintuitive, but majority rule is actually a better way to foster compromise than requiring a supermajority. And this is something that the framers specifically noted themselves. And the reason that they knew this was that they had just had direct firsthand experience with the Articles of Confederation, which, of course, was the first draft of American government, right? Mm-hmm. And the Articles of Confederation required a supermajority threshold for all major pieces of legislation to pass in its version of Congress. And they put this in place thinking that this would facilitate compromise, because it seems intuitive. But what they saw firsthand was that requiring a supermajority, instead of facilitating compromise, gives the side that is on the minority in any given debate the ability to stop the majority from acting and make them look bad and manufacture gridlock. And so when the framers were writing the Constitution, they were very clear that they didn't want this to happen. And they basically, you know, in sort of prophetic terms, called what we see today. Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 22 explained that the supermajority might at first sight seem like a remedy, but was, in his words, in fact, a poison, because what it did was give the minority the ability to embarrass the administration, to gridlock it, and to make it unable to do anything so that the minority could then get back in power, arguing that, you know, the majority didn't deliver on its promises. And that's what we see today. So, you know, I would point to certain things to show how lowering the threshold can actually facilitate compromise. If this threshold for passing things in the Senate was 50 and not the relatively arbitrary threshold of 60, you would be able to pick up a few Republicans here and there. You probably wouldn't be able to get all the way to 60 because things are so polarized, and it's hard to count 10 Republicans on any given bill who would cross over and vote with Democrats. But for instance, on the vote to call witnesses during the impeachment trial this past January, you had 5 Republicans cross over and vote with Democrats to call witnesses. That was a healthy bipartisan majority of 55 senators. That only required a majority to pass because of the special rules that apply to impeachment proceedings. But let's say that had been a bill in the Senate, you would have gotten 5 Republicans, which was a major bipartisan accomplishment, but it still would have failed because you didn't get to 60. And so, you know, we are in such a polarized era that it's going to take some baby steps to start thawing the partisan entrenchment. But those baby steps begin with picking up a few Republicans here and there on big bills like the infrastructure package that's probably coming down the pike, which is likely to be broadly popular. And infrastructure traditionally has always been an issue where you have broad bipartisan support. But the idea that if you can't get 10 Republicans, it doesn't count is silly. And if you put the threshold back at 50, maybe you pick up a few Republicans here and there. And maybe that is the type of thaw that begins to break down some of our partisan entrenchment.
Adam Gentleson with us, former aide to Democratic Senator Harry Reid. His new book is Kill Switch. Let's bring in Rich now in Rhinelander. Rich, hi. Go ahead.
Hi. You'll have to decide whether this fits or not. It seems to me that a number of really societally altering or challenging decisions in sexual politics were reached judicially. That is, the decision for women to have access to abortion, and more recently in 2015, the decision that gay people, that would include me, have the right to get married if they want to get married. The current drive by the Republican Party to sort of define the courts as highly conservative seems to come out of that. And there's also an undermining, it seems to me, of the idea that Congress is actually the place where laws should be made. I'll stop there. So
yeah, Rich, thank you. And Adam, you know, certainly appointments to the high court factoring in here with the filibuster conversation.
Yes, absolutely. So a couple threads there that I want to run down. It's a very good point. You know, on a balance of power perspective, Congress is supposed to be the centerpiece. It was supposed to be it's the most democratic of the three branches. And it was supposed to be the main font of legislation and, you know, creator of laws. A gridlocked legislative branch shifts power to the less democratic branches of our government, the presidency, where, you know, you get one election to vote one person in and then it's winner take all, and the judiciary, where, of course, people are not elected at all. So having a gridlocked legislative branch, as we have today, shifts more power to the less democratic parts of our government, and that's probably not a good thing. The courts have in the past made some landmark civil rights decisions, but they've also made some very reactionary, regressive decisions. And I think the courts are an unreliable source of expansions of rights generally, especially now that they've been stacked so extensively with conservative judges who are far outside the mainstream in their opinions from many Americans. So I would argue that, you know, having a functioning legislative branch is even more important today to be able to counter some of the reactionary decisions that we're likely to see continuing to come down from the Supreme Court. Just to point to one, I would point to the 2013 Shelby decision, where Chief Justice Roberts authored the majority opinion gutting the Voting Rights Act and opening the door to much of the voter suppression that we see rampant in elections today. Congress is trying to pass a fix to that and to pass a strengthened Voting Rights Act, but it's being stopped by the filibuster. It passed the House of Representatives just last week. It's going to come over to the Senate, and Republicans have made clear that they're not going to vote for it, so it won't get 10 Republicans, therefore it won't get 60 votes, and it will fail in the Senate. But having a functioning legislative branch is essential to be able to counter some of these decisions that are coming down.
And I'm going to pause right there with author Adam Gentleson, our guide to the Senate's filibuster. And he writes, the use of opaque parliamentary tactics creates a deeply unhealthy, perhaps unsustainable dynamic in our democracy. What do you think? Has the filibuster changed over time? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Adam Gentleson here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about the Senate's filibuster rule. Author Adam Gentleson lays out that over the past 50 years, the filibuster has become entwined with structures of top-down partisan control that have transformed the Senate. The filibuster was conceived of a supermajority of 60 senators to bring a measure to a vote. It was supposed to promote broadly acceptable compromises, but that's not how the rule has played out, becoming a tool for obstruction. And Adam Gentleson is with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Jim now in River Falls. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Yeah, I thank you so much for having the program. I'm just wondering what your guest thinks it will take to get some of the more conservative members of the Senate, like Joe Manchin and Joe Biden, too, said he's opposed to eliminating the filibuster. So what does he think it might take to do that? I mean, the obstructionists of the Republicans may force them, I think, hopefully, to see the light. But and what can constituents do to help support changing the rules to eliminate the filibuster?
Yeah, Jim, thank you.
I'm very glad you asked that, Jim. You know, I think your point that Republicans might force their hands is a very perceptive one. You know, President Biden has said he opposes rules changes. He said that would be his preference, was the word that White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki used the other day. I thought that was somewhat interesting choice of words to say preference. And President Biden himself, when asked about it last year, said that the question of reform would depend on how obstreperous Republicans became. And I think you see similar statements from a lot of senators who were skeptical of reform, but are sort of being forced there because there's just no other way to pass anything. And Republicans are refusing to cooperate on anything. Even Joe Manchin has started to shift a little bit. I would love to see him shift more, but I think the fact that he's already shifting says a lot about where this conversation is headed. So at the end of the day, I think, you know, Democrats are going to face a choice. And back to the first caller's point about, you know, fearing untrammeled majority rule, I think what's going to become clear is that the filibuster isn't standing in the way of far left policies like Medicare for All. It's standing in the way of consensus, common sense, pragmatic, bipartisan solutions. When I say bipartisan, I mean out in the real world where they have, you know, support of Republicans and Democrats among the American public. And once it becomes clear, as it will in the coming weeks and months, that the filibuster is the thing standing in the way of these centrist policies, then I think the reform conversation is going to get much more serious. And look, you already have most of the Democratic caucus in favor of reform. That's a good place to start. And I think, you know, bringing the last few senators over the line, it will be events and the continued obstruction of Republicans that force it along. Look, I would love to see Republicans drop their obstruction and work with Democrats. And if they do that, reform probably won't be necessary. But I don't think that's going to happen. And to the question about what constituents can do, well, you know, in Wisconsin, you have one senator who supports reform in Senator Baldwin and one senator in Senator Johnson who opposes reform. So if, you know, you have and he's up for election in 2022. So that would be an issue where I think constituents could certainly make their voices heard, because that is going to be a question that will be central to the next 2 years and certainly come up a lot in this next election.
Let's look more closely at reform and a piece of this that you were very close to in 2013 when Senator Harry Reid, whom you worked for as senior aide, made the decision to go nuclear by getting rid of the filibuster for judicial nominations. What was the nuclear option? How did it work?
So the nuclear option is sort of a hyperbolic term that we give. It was coined in the early 2000s by columnist William Safire. When there was a big debate, when actually the roles were reversed and Republicans wanted to go nuclear to confirm President George Bush's, some of his more controversial nominees, including actually Brett Kavanaugh, who at the time was being up for confirmation to the D.C. Circuit. But what it describes is simply the act to vote on a majority vote basis to alter the Senate rules. And The reason this is controversial is that one of the changes, we were discussing Richard Russell earlier, one of the changes that Russell made in one of his power grabs to secure and strengthen the filibuster was to basically put any changes to that rule out of reach of future generations and made it virtually impossible to change that rule. So since then, senators have found other ways to change the rule. The reason you can do it by a majority vote is basically that the Senate is designed to change, and it's designed to reflect the will of a majority of its members. You know, if the Senate decided tomorrow to vote to change the rule and to recognize that the sky was green and all sky-related legislation needed to reflect this fact, it could do that. Mm-hmm. Of course, you're not going to get a majority of senators to vote to that, but it is supposed to be an evolving body. You know, reform is something that has happened through the years. And so when a majority of its members vote to change its rules, that change stands. And so that is a tactic that Senator Reid used to alter the rules in 2013. It's also the tactic Senator McConnell used twice when he was majority leader to alter the rules as well. So it's an established tactic that both parties have used. And the good news about reform is that it could happen tomorrow. All you need is a majority of senators to decide to do it through this method, and it can happen. So it will be controversial. There will be a lot of attention to it, but it is something that's been done in the past and reflects the idea that the framers had that the Senate should be able to change and evolve and adapt as it faced new challenges and new generations.
I want to look more closely at this acronym that you shape, White Wealthy Interest Anti-Choice Conservatives. What is that description you feel in relation to the filibuster?
That is the constituency that drives the opposition and the entrenched partisanship that we are seeing today. Now, to be clear, both sides, and I say this in the book, participate in polarized politics, and both sides take advantage of this partisanship and toe the party line. But what's different about the Republican Party is it represents a minority. Both Republican presidents to come to power this century, since the turn of the 21st century, have been elected, at least the first time, by winning fewer votes than their opponent. Republicans in the Senate, every single time they've held the majority in the Senate, have represented a minority of the population. At no point in the 21st century have Senate Republicans represented a majority of the population. Now, within that, 45 to 49% of Americans that Senate Republicans represent, their decisions are largely driven by what I describe as a super minority, the WWAC population that I described there. And I think we're seeing that today. Not all Republicans are members of that subgroup. However, the party's decision and the direction of the party is driven increasingly by what that subgroup wants. That's why you see the party refuse to stand up to Donald Trump. It's why you see Republican lawmakers refuse in many cases to even condemn the January 6th riots. And so part of what's wrong with our politics today is that we don't just have two parties, seeking compromise. We have one party that is being driven off into extreme areas by this super minority that is much more powerful than any other single group in American politics.
Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Adam Gentleson is a former deputy chief of staff to Senator Harry Reid, the former Democratic leader. His book is called Kill Switch: The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network.